Okay, good morning, just everybody. My name is Kirsten Ainley. I'm from the London School of Economics, and I'm delighted to have been asked to chair this session. The session title is Extraordinary Rendition and State Complicity, Perspectives from Law, International Relations and Human Rights Monitoring. Unfortunately, one of our panellists can't be here. She's had a family emergency, so Anne Fitzgerald won't be here today. What that means is that we both get longer to hear the other two panellists speak and also a longer discussion / Q&A session at the end. But what I will do is ask, without much further ado, our two panellists, Jane Huckabee and Jason Ralph, to speak for approximately 25 minutes each, 20, 25 minutes each, and then we'll have 25 minutes, half an hour, for a discussion session at the end. So we briefly introduce our first speaker, Jane Huckabee, who is the Research Director at the Centre for Human Rights and Global Justice at New York University School of Law. Jane's also been a consultant at the International Centre for Transitional Justice on Gender and Transitional Justice Issues and the United Nations Development Fund for Women. Jane will be speaking today on legal and factual questions in extraordinary rendition. So over to you.
Thank you, Kirsten. So as Kirsten mentioned, I work at the Centre for Human Rights and Global Justice at NYU School of Law, and I also co-teach the International Human Rights Clinic at the Law School as well. I want to, before getting into the core of my presentation, give a brief overview of sort of the three core areas of the work of the Centre and the Clinic in the areas of rendition and secret detention. And then to reflect upon how some of those activities inform my discussion on legal and factual aspects on rendition. So the three key areas. First of all, the clinic, International Human Rights Clinic, represents two former CIA detainees. These are two Yemeni nationals, Mohammed al-Assad and Mohammed Bashmila, who were apprehended, rendered, and secretly detained by the CIA between 2003 and 2006. Mohammed Bashmila is a plaintiff in the ACLU-led Jefferson case, and I'll talk more about that later on. It's a case involving suing a private company for its role in the US rendition and secret detention program. Alongside the representation of individual clients, the center, in collaboration with Amnesty International USA, Center for Constitutional Rights, and a private law firm, also pursue freedom of information litigation pertaining to rendition and secret detention. That has involved, very roughly, filing a series of what are called FOIA requests with various agencies and then litigating the non-release of documents by the US government pursuant to that request. The third area, alongside a representation of clients, alongside a FOIA litigation, is to really provide, in our university capacity, a lot of research and policy advice to various actors, everything from our NGO colleagues. I want to acknowledge Asim Qureshi from Cage Prisoners, who is here with whom we've worked for many years, but also to work with UN entities working on these questions. So, for example, right now the Centre has a project looking at the gender manifestations of counterterrorism measures in support of the UN Rapporteur on fundamental freedoms while countering terrorism, but also to support governmental entities that are seeking to grapple with the questions about rendition and secret detention too. So advising President Obama's new task forces, working with various members of Congress and so forth. That's sort of the background, and I'll be drawing upon, as I mentioned, the examples from those particular experiences as I talk about these legal and policy questions pertaining to rendition. But before we even get into those quite complex legal and policy questions, it'd be helpful to begin with an even more complex starting point, which is actually, what are we talking about? What is the terminology of referring to rendition? What is the terminology entailed in referring to rendition to justice and extraordinary rendition? So just to start with what rendition means when used by the US previous US administration. So President Bush, former Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice, former CIA Director Michael Hayden, have all repeatedly acknowledged in quite public forums that the US government uses rendition to transfer individuals to third countries for an interrogation. They've admitted it. There's no secret about the use of transfers for that purpose. But what's very important to remember is when they admit rendition, they're not admitting extraordinary rendition as we understand it. They're talking about rendition in US parlance, which is known as rendition to justice. Okay? That term is one, as Zachary mentioned this morning, was developed by President Reagan to allow rendition to the United States for the purpose of criminal prosecution. So basically what it would involve is someone being picked up in a foreign country but brought to the US for a trial. And that is a process that has been endorsed in the United States to the level of the Supreme Court in the case of Alvarez Machain, saying effectively, and I'm really nutshelling this doctrine, that it doesn't matter how you get here, once you're here, you're in our jurisdiction and we'll prosecute you accordingly. And that practice really evolved, again, as Zach mentioned this morning. It was expanded by the first President Bush, and then it really escalated during the Clinton years to become not just about transfer back to the United States, but also transfer to third countries. Okay? So, but that's what, when you hear the US administration talking about that they engage in rendition, that's the type of practice to which they're referring. Okay? Rendition either to the United States or to third countries for criminal prosecution purposes. But what we have when we talk about extraordinary rendition is a shift from that process. It's not a complete shift in the sense that it really has its derivations in the rendition justice model, but it is a new form of rendition. What's new about a post 9/11 rendition program is a couple of things. The key thing is that it really is for the purpose of interrogation to countries. It's really transferred for the purpose of interrogation to countries that are known for systematic use of torture. A hallmark of extraordinary rendition is that individuals are not given an opportunity to challenge their transfers either before or after that transfer takes place. So, for example, coming back to our clients, between 2003 and 2006, Mohammed Al-Assad was rendered four times to a total of four different countries, and Mohammed Bashmila was rendered three times to a total of three different countries, but no time at any point of transfer were they given the opportunity to challenge the transfer, nor were they informed of their future destination. Actually, they weren't even informed of their current destination. They had no idea of where they were. And, of course, were not given any chance to challenge it afterward either. The other thing to talk about, and this is important from a legal perspective and from a human rights perspective, is that sometimes these transfers occur with the consent of the state from which they're being transferred. So, for example, like if you're picked up in somewhere like Pakistan and then you're rendered from Pakistan to Afghanistan, likely that rendering took place with the consent of the Pakistani government. But there are times when actually the host state does not consent to that transfer taking place. So when the Secret Service agents of a particular country go in and undertake a clandestine kidnapping and then get the individual out of the territory without the host state even knowing about it. Even in situations where the host state does consent to the individual being removed, that's not the end of the human rights question. I mean, there are significant implications for human rights protections that occur even in those circumstances, and I'll talk more about that later on. So just to sort of track the shift, we had rendition to justice, we have extraordinary rendition, and now we're looking at potentially, with the new Obama administration, a return to pre-9/11 rendition practices. In particular, right after coming into office, President Obama issued on January 22nd a series of executive orders, one of which rescinded the CIA's post 9/11 authorities on rendition, to third countries or into secret detention, but didn't address the issue of the pre 9/11 rendition authority. And so the big question now is, what will that authority look like going forward? And I think the afternoon panel, in particular Julia, will speak about, you know, what are the policy options going forward on this front. So we really are at a very key decision-making point with the new administration as to what will be the rules governing transfers when the torture is not involved, but, you know, what will be the rules for non-extraordinary rendition, essentially. I think no one would argue that extraordinary rendition is legal. No one would ever seriously mount that argument. So now we're back to the question of what do you do when you have an individual in a state that you want to get out of that state? What are the rules that pertain to that form of transfer? And in particular, President Obama has set up a series of special interagency task forces looking at that exact question. If you sort of look at those executive orders that I mentioned from January 22nd, but also take a step back and look at the last 8 years, I want to sort of map out what are the actual transfers that we're talking about here? Like, what have been the typical informal transfers, what we call extraordinary rendition? What have been the patterns that we've seen through all of our various work with different detainee populations? So the first one, it's not often talked about as rendition, but it should be, is transfers to and from Guantanamo. Okay, so people being picked up and so, for example, transferred from Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan into Gitmo Bay, or people transferred from a secret prison into Guantanamo Bay. Also, not only transfers to Guantanamo, but transfers out of Guantanamo. Okay, so we hear a lot about, particularly in the recent ICRC report that was recently released, it's not a recent report, it's from 2007, about actually the fact that the allegations that people were transferred into Guantanamo and then transferred out again to secret prisons. So these movements in and out of Guantanamo without regular process are rendition, and they're not talked about in that way often, but they should be thought about in that light. The second form of transfers are transfers by the CIA. Okay, there's a couple of different types of those transfers. A key one, and again this is implicated by our client's perspective, are transfers into secret detention, so into black sites. Okay, I think one thing to draw attention to in that regard and is very recently, as many of you would know, President Obama released a whole bunch of OLC memos that groups have been fighting for years. These are Office of Legal Counsel memos from the Department of Justice that seek to authorise various things. So, for example, the use of interrogation techniques in combination, the use of interrogation techniques against a particular detainee, Adriana Zubaydah, also mentioned this morning. These memos are really horrifying but also essential reading for anyone who wants to get a sense of really the degree to which the programs over the last 8 years have had an extraordinary empty but nonetheless present legal gloss. One thing that's really interesting in the memo that was released dated May 10, 2005, and it's a memo that seeks to really say that, okay, here are these interrogation techniques we've previously authorised, when can they be used in combination? Which is a very problematic question with a very problematic answer in this memo. But one thing it talks about actually is that there are three phases of interrogation. And those phases, the first one of which is actually the initial conditions. I'm just looking for the exact phrase. So the first phase of the interrogation process is initial conditions, and that sets the stage for future interrogation techniques. So it's really talking about the way in which it describes the rendition process. So, for example, the fact that, you know, someone is picked up, that someone is put through this process that we've heard detainees describe. So, for example, where they have... where they're blindfolded, where they're shackled, where it just varies a little bit from detainee, where they've had goggles put over their eyes. Sometimes they have gauze put in between the goggles and their eyes. They're put in a diaper. They are sometimes administered a suppository, some prescription, although, again, that seems to vary to some degree. And then, you know, have this extraordinary process performed by what now has been termed the CIA rendition team. These are individuals who are clad head to toe in black, who administer this procedure sometimes in the tarmac of an airport, sometimes in an office like somewhere near the airport. But it's really a procedure designed to maximise disorientation. The detainee is then either put flat on the plane floor, that sometimes happens. Sometimes they're in a slightly inclined position, and then flown to an unknown location. And again, this is something that's really designed to ensure that individuals are massively disoriented before even getting to the detention site. So CIA transfers, one option is to go into a secret black site, in places like Afghanistan and also Eastern Europe, for example, Poland. Another option for CIA flights has been to be flown to third countries for interrogation. That often happens, for example, to countries like Egypt. But it would be a mistake to think these are the only two options and that you only go through one. Sometimes they're used in combination. So you could be sent to a third country for interrogation, then you could be sent from that third country into a black site, then you could be sent to another black site, you could be sent back to the black site. It's a very disorienting program, and it's really designed to have a sense that you really have no idea either where you're going or where you are. And as you could imagine, there's a really a lack of control over the entire process, which further destabilizes detainees. So the other thing to note is that alongside these transfers into CO black sites, alongside transfers to third countries, a massive form of transfer, which has been really not looked at in any proper detail yet, has been what happened when the CIA emptied its black sites. Okay, now, the CIA has acknowledged that the majority of people held in its program were transferred to their countries of origin. But we have no information about that transfer process. We have no information about what happened to those individuals on their return. We do know, for example, the number that were put into what we call proxy detention arrangements. So what they were sent back, and I'll talk about our clients here again, they were sent back to Yemen with an instruction to the Yemeni government to hold them until further information was sent by the United States. Okay? These individuals languished, they arrived back and languished for another number of months until they were actually put on trial by a Yemeni court and found innocent of any charges. So this process of proxy detention is one that we know, for example, has also happened in relation to Libya. So a number of people who were held in CIA black sites who were sent back to Libya and who still have not had a chance to interact with human rights advocates at all or to see attorney representation, to my knowledge, yet. So, you know, there's a lot of... If we know from the US government that they have told us that they held around 100 people in a CIA secret black site program, we know only 19 of them are at Guantanamo. What happened to the other 81 who were transferred back to their countries of origin? And what was the process that pertained to that transfer? And what was the process that pertained to their conditions of return? Given that we know publicly right now the challenges that pertain when negotiating transfers back from Guantanamo, you can only imagine they're amplified in the secret CIA context. And just one more thing to comment on, again, for legal purposes, is to note the important role of the actual aircraft utilised in these transfers. One pattern that has emerged from NGO documentation, from intergovernmental documentation, particularly that by the Council of Europe, indicates the important role of private planes, private aircraft, to transfer individuals between secret facilities, into secret facilities, and so forth. There's a couple of things, reasons why that happens. The main reason appears to be the goal to minimise detection, and in particular to take advantage of the different rules that pertain under international aviation law for civil and state aircraft. I'm happy to go into this more on questions. It's a very technical area of international aviation law with which I never thought I'd have to become familiar. But if you are civil aircraft making a non-scheduled international flight, you don't have to request prior permission to entering a territory. Okay. So basically, you have to file a flight plan. There are certain things, obviously, from a civil aviation perspective, safety perspective, that apply. But it's much easier to mask the nature of your route. And that's very important if you're thinking about maintaining a secret prison network, is you don't want the plane routes to be easily detectable, because then you can begin to pick up patterns as to where particular planes go at particular times and therefore identify locations of secret prisons. What the challenge has been from a legal perspective is that often when you begin to, if you can get to the stage where you figure out what the airline companies involved are called, often you do research on those entities and find out they're actually shell companies for the CIA, or they actually have no business entity that support them. So that makes it difficult from a legal perspective to pursue any type of litigation against them. However, one case where that didn't happen is in the case of Jefferson Data Plan, Inc. Jefferson Data Plan, Inc., a Boeing subsidiary, who were involved, well, basically the petition that was filed in 2007 by the ACLU, in which we're a plaintiff and also co-counsel, indicates and alleges that Jefferson provided extensive flight services to the CIA, to the US government, that enable the CIA to render individuals into these programs. Let me give you a more concrete example of what that means in practice. So our client, Mohammed Bashamila, had gone to Jordan in late 2003 to help his mother undergo a heart procedure. He was detained by the GID, the Mukhabarat, in Amman, Jordan, for approximately a month, and a little over a month. And then one day in the early hours of the morning, was picked up. It was early in the morning in October, and put on a Jeppesen plane to Afghanistan, where he was held in a secret prison run by the United States government. So, you know, in that particular circumstance, it's alleged in the petition that the flight that transported Mohammed Bashmila from Jordan to Afghanistan was flight M379P, a well-known rendition flight, and that Jeppesen provided extensive services pertaining to that flight, including filing of flight plans, refueling, etc. And we can track, the Jeppesen lawsuit actually tracks the role of Jeppesen in the rendition of five different plaintiffs, all of whom, you should definitely, I encourage you to read the complaint and read the harrowing nature of their stories, but all of whom were sent into various circumstances with the involvement of the US government and with the involvement of a private aircraft. And that was an unusual case because Jeppesen actually does exist as a company, so you could actually go after the corporate entity. And also because, and this is all public record, there are individuals within Jeppesen who are prepared to talk about the boasting that took place within Jeppesen about their role in CIA rendition flights. And so there was very concrete evidentiary foundations, which often are lacking in rendition cases. So I want to quickly talk about exactly how extraordinary rendition violates international law. And this is kind of a fun and complicated question, only because really the violations occur in multiples. They occur at multiple stages. So one thing that's really important to remember when we talk about rendition is you have to really locate where the violations occur. It occurs at the moment of apprehension, the kidnapping aspect. It occurs at the moment of transfer, and it also occurs in terms of your destination from your transfer, so your detention too. So we have multiple stages of abuse potential. But we also have multiple locations for abuse, and this is one, sort of something that makes it quite difficult, but also very problematic from a human rights perspective, is that really these abuses take place in multiple countries. Okay, so for example, you could be apprehended in one country, you can be transited through many countries, and then you can be detained in many countries. So there's really many states that are implicated in the practice of extraordinary rendition. And the third multiple is multiple actors. Okay, so you have actors, you have local state, the officials from the state in which you're apprehended, you have the officials who were transferring you, and you have the officials of the state in which you're detained. There can be three different sets of officials in any given scenario. Similarly, you have, as I mentioned already, with the role of Jeppesen, Data Plan Inc., you have non-state actors involved as well, and of course there are challenges that pertain in bringing human rights claims against non-state actors as well. So multiple stages of abuse, multiple locations of abuse, and multiple actors. And you would think in all those circumstances that actually you'd have multiple chances to therefore bring claims, but actually it tends to be in the inverse. So, you know, this system is designed in such a way to really muddy the areas of responsibility and to really muddy the demarcation around where you can sue and against whom you can sue. But if you, and I'll talk about those challenges momentarily, but if you did want to sue and if you wanted to draw attention to the rights violations, there have been many to which you could point. One is to, in particular, the prohibition of torture. That's a very obvious one. But also particularly the norm that's most implicated, a norm that's particularly implicated by rendition practices is the prohibition on refoulement. Okay, so it's a prohibition under international law on transfers to transfer an individual to another state where they face a risk of torture. Very strong prohibition under international human rights law. But another factor that's really important, particularly for transiting states, so states where airplanes fly through, but also very important for states that actually host secret prisons, is an obligation to prevent torture. The obligation is not just to not do torture, it's also an obligation to prevent it happening, and particularly to prevent it happening to anyone in your jurisdiction. Okay, and obviously, if you are on the territory of a state, you're within that territory's jurisdiction, so it's a very important obligation to prevent. Another very important obligation, particularly for transit states as well, and such as or states that somehow have enabled rendition to occur, is the obligation of the duty to investigate. Okay, and it's something that is really, when there is a substantiated allegation of torture or a complicity in torture, there is an obligation to investigate. under international human rights law. That investigation must be efficient, it must be impartial, and it must be effective. Those are sort of the key requirements of investigation. When you have the information giving rise to a suspicion. And various states have responded to that duty in various ways. Sometimes you'll see, for example, in the case of Romania, an investigation by the Senate that looks like it's doing something into the secret retention program, it doesn't do very much. That doesn't meet the standards of the duty to investigate under international law. Other countries have also started to do this, but no one's actually fully implemented the obligation yet. And it's a very important one because right now, if you try and talk to a lot of governments about their role in rendition and secret retention, what they'll say to you is, well, you show me the evidence that your client was held here, or you show me the evidence of the secret prison on my territory. And that's actually not the right question. Now, the right question is, actually, I can show you the evidence indicating that, but now it's your role as a state government to activate your duty to investigate to fulfill that accordingly. The argument that you show me the evidence is a very common one in the Romanian context in particular. So you have this body of international human rights law, but you also have a body of international aviation law that is really relevant here and which there are very substantial grounds for believing there's been breaches of international aviation law. Again, I'm very happy to go into the technicalities, but one big breach that I'll draw attention to, which the Venice Commission has also drawn attention to, is really that if it's the case, which we believe it is and which we know it is from certain areas, if it's the case that a rendition flight a rendition flight enters a territory saying it's a private aircraft when really it's actually performing a state function, okay, so doing something for a state purpose, which means it's actually a state aircraft. If it's the case that it's improperly declaring that its nature coming into the territory, then it has breached the international aviation law. And that's very important. I'm going to take a step back, not to get too technical, thank you, is that under international aviation law, state aircraft can't enter a territory without permission. And that makes a lot of sense, right? Because you don't want another country's aircraft coming into your territory without any sort of knowledge or check or permission system. So there are strict requirements that pertain to state aircraft, and they have to have permission, they have to act within the scope of that permission. And so if you are really a state aircraft, because you're performing a state function, like a rendition flight would be a state aircraft, but you're coming in pretending to be a private aircraft, and that's a deliberate obfuscation that is really trying to evade the application of the International Aviation Conventions, in particular the Chicago Convention. I've only got 5 minutes, so I'm just going to sort of skip through to what the challenges are for obtaining redress for victims of rendition. And I've mentioned already, the key challenge is really figuring out who to sue and where to sue them, basically. That's a short way of saying it. It can be a factual challenge. So, for example, there's like a big feature of the rendition program was like filing like dummy flight plans, or changing flight plans at the last minute, or filing a flight plan and changing it, not via the flight plan system, but changing it via a facsimile that was sent through 1 minute before the aircraft landed. So there's a lot of evidentiary work that has to be done, even just figuring out like where a flight even went, what country did it traverse, at what time, and so forth. Also, detainees themselves, even though they can, if they're in a place of detention, they can describe their environment, or they can describe, for example, the length of the flight. You know, they're not aware of what countries they're passing over on their flight. They're often not aware of where they're even going. So, you know, there's a lot of issues that sort of factual issues that pertain in putting together a case. Another big challenge has been one I've already mentioned, is really the issue about access to detainees who remain missing. So detainees that we know have been subject to rendition. We've written a report in collaboration with Caged Prisoners, Reprieve, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, and Center for Constitutional Rights, that actually identifies people that we think are still missing, that really are still off the record. And I can happily refer people to that report. But really getting access to those people is a real challenge. Another challenge is pertains to destruction of evidence. So we know in the US context, for example, it's been admitted by former CIA Director Michael Hayden that the CIA destroyed videotapes of detainees who had been subject to coercive interrogation techniques. Alongside that, there are restrictions on testimony by former CIA detainees. Many of you would know that the former CIA detainees in Guantanamo now, the so-called high values, There are a number of them. They are not allowed to speak up publicly, and their attorneys are not allowed to speak up publicly either on their behalf. So it's wealth of information that would help us really understand that the full scope of violations that occurred is being deliberately blocked by the US government on the grounds of state secrets. And on that point, a big challenge to gaining redress, particularly in the US context, but also in other contexts too, has been invocation by governments of what they call the state secret privilege. Okay, basically what that means is that they argue that you cannot even bring a case to court because to even talk about the issues will implicate national security. And that has resulted in the dismissing of a number of cases at the pleading stage, not even at the stage of hearing evidence. We actually, brief light in many years of fighting, had a victory at the end of last month in the US Court of Appeals in the Jefferson case. What happened in that case, and I know I'm pretty out of time, but just very briefly, we had sued Jefferson, the private company. The US government turned up to argue. The Jefferson never made an argument yet. The US government turned up and said, you can't even hear this case because it's state secrets and, you know, we can't even talk about it. The district court actually agreed with the government and dismissed the case at the district court level. We appealed, led by the ACLU, to the Court of Appeals, and we had a decision on April 28th that actually the district court was wrong, that the government, that it needs to be remanded and reversed. And that's a key victory in the US context because state secrets has so far been used to deny other cases, and it's been a real, real block in terms of ensuring accountability. One thing I had wanted to talk about, but maybe we'll come out in questions a little bit more, and maybe in the afternoon session, is one thing that the Centre is working on a lot right now is proposing what should be the human rights protections that pertain in informal transfers. Like, so we can look back and talk about the renditions that have taken place, and we can think about how to ensure redress, but how do we also ensure going forward that these things don't happen again? And I'm not going to go into, we have a very detailed proposal that we tend to sort of try and disseminate as much as possible, but I want to say two things about it. One is that the protections under international human rights law in regard to informal transfers have both procedural aspects and substantive aspects. And the procedural aspects are really important and often not talked about. And what I mean by that is you have to have a right to challenge a transfer. You know, before you get transferred somewhere, it is essential that an individual be given a meaningful process to be able to raise fear of mistreatment prior to being transferred. And I think I'm going to stop on that and maybe talk a bit more on question time.
Jane, thank you very much. Okay, the next speaker on the panel, Jason Welf, is a senior lecturer in international relations at the University of Leeds, whose principal work is in the area of the English School of International Relations, but has started work relatively recently, I think, on an ESRC-funded project analysing the political strength of exceptionalist thinking of the concepts, Schmittian concepts of the exception on security policies in the Bush administration and that of its successor, this very brave man, two of the most unpopular men in the 20th century, Carl Schmitt and George Bush. And the ESRC are still funding the research. But Jason will be talking today on extraordinary rendition and the retreat of international society since 9/11.
Okay, thank you, Kirsten. Okay, building on that project that Kirsten mentioned, I'm going to focus my remarks on the Bush and the Obama administration and what they've been doing in this area of extraordinary rendition. And of course, in this respect, this conference couldn't have been better timed, because this past couple of months, what we've had is the release of an avalanche of new material based on what the Bush administration has been doing. And I'm just going to list some of those just as a way of introduction. So on March the 2nd, we had the release of 9 memoranda from the Office of the Legal Counsel, which of course is in the Department of Justice, made up of the lawyers like John Yoo, Jay Bybee, Stephen Bradbury. And this raft of memoranda included what I call in my paper the rendition memo, which is a memo released on March the 13th, 2002, that dealt specifically with this question of the legal status of detainees and the legal arguments concerning their transfer to foreign jurisdictions. On April the 9th, we had the release of a November 2007 Red Cross report, which was based on the testimony of those that were interrogated under this program. And this report unambiguously stated that the interrogation techniques that were being used were not enhanced interrogation, but in fact torture, which of course contradicted the Bush administration's claim that enhanced interrogation fell short of the definition of torture, and I'll say more about that later. April the 16th, we had the release of four more memoranda from the Office of the Legal Counsel under the Bush administration, this time memoranda to the CIA stating that there was no legal obstacle to the use of enhanced interrogation of al-Qaeda operatives. Then on April 22nd, we had the release of a declassified narrative from the Senate Intelligence Committee, which gives details on when the administration, the political administration, was the National Security Council, when they were briefed of the CIA interrogation proposals. And here, based on this, proposals, reports implicating people like Condoleezza Rice and others on the National Security Council. Then the following day, we had the release of a report from the Senate Armed Services Committee, which charts the migration of these interrogation techniques from Guantanamo to Iraq, and concluded, quote, that the abuse of detainees in U.S. custody cannot simply be attributed to the actions of a few bad apples acting on their own. So we've had, over this past month, like I said, a lot of material on this particular topic. And I should say here that it would have been impossible to keep on top of this material if it hadn't been for the work of my researcher, Dominique Svark. Unfortunately, she can't be here, but I'd like to go on record of thanking her and saying she's doing an excellent job, and also acknowledge the support of the ASRC here. So against this background, what I want to focus my remarks on are four areas. I want to reaffirm this idea of rendition being something that preceded 9/11 and the Bush administration, and talk about the different definitions, but also say something about what that means for the numbers that have been involved in the CIA Extraordinary Rendition Program. Then I want to say something about the legal arguments that have been used by the lawyers that I mentioned, you, Bybee, Gonzalez, in these memos, and pick up on some of the arguments that they're making there. And thirdly, I want to draw some implications from these arguments for the international relations students, if there are any here. Like I say, I'm an international relations academic, I'm not a lawyer. But what I want to do there is draw some implications out from these legal arguments for the discipline of international relations in the spirit of interdisciplinary research, and focus in particular on the idea of international society. And given that we're at the LSE, what I'm going to try to do is link some of these implications to the work of John Vincent, who of course was a professor of international relations here at the LSE. And then finally, what I want to do is say something about President Obama's response to this question, picking up on some of the discussions that we've had about the difficulties of prosecutions and other forms of redress. So firstly, some clarifications on definitions and the definitions I'm working with. So as we've heard, what we're talking about is the transfer of terrorist suspects between jurisdictions. But what makes it all extraordinary, as Jane was pointing out, is that it's not extradition, which is the normal process of due process transferring individuals between jurisdictions for the purpose of trial. Rendition involves potentially unlawful, and I was interested to hear the point that this US Supreme Court has said it's not necessarily unlawful, but rendition is still within the context of law enforcement, rendition to justice, as we've heard. Extraordinary rendition involves the unlawful transfer of terrorist suspects for the purpose of interrogation, and an assumption in this most recent context that the techniques used will be ones that the US would prefer not to use. I think that's an important point there. So my working definition of extraordinary rendition is the transfer of suspected terrorists by the US to foreign states in circumstances that make it more likely than not that the individual will be subjected to torture or cruel, inhuman, and degraded treatment. And that was a quote from the NYU report, Torture by Proxy. Now, like I said, I think there are a couple of points here, some of which have been made by Zachary and made by Jane, and that is that with these definitions, it's clear that a rendition program existed prior to the Bush administration, prior to the 9/11 attacks. So, for instance, we had there the rendition of suspected terrorists that were kidnapped. The case I've come across is a case of a person being kidnapped in Croatia, and with CIA involvement, with US involvement, and being rendered to Egypt. This was during the 1990s. But the purpose there, the objective of that act, was law enforcement. It was rendered to justice. And okay, while there are human rights implications and questions here at the point of kidnap, of course, and as Jane said, at the point of trial, the assumption here was that pre-9/11, a rendition program still existed in a law enforcement context. And that affected the number and the character of the renditions. So the number was kept fairly low, and the character, of course, was for law enforcement rather than for interrogation. After 9/11, we had this shift from a law enforcement paradigm, if you like, to a war paradigm in many respects. But in here, in this particular context, this meant that rendition was not necessarily simply for law enforcement, not necessarily rendition for justice, but rendition for intelligence. Rendition for interrogation for intelligence purposes, not for evidence purposes. As Michael Schur, the CIA counterterrorism expert, put it, after 9/11, the gloves came off. So rendition was extraordinary because US policy was now conceived in a war rather than in a law enforcement setting, and it is extraordinary because it was interested in intelligence rather than evidence. As a result, the numbers increased and the character of the renditions changed. Now, the second point I'd make here is again to do with this question of how many individuals have been involved in the CIA extraordinary rendition program. And I'm working on the assumption that we can't say that all of the 759 detainees that have been at one time or another at Guantanamo are part of the extraordinary rendition program. There's something that Jane was saying, that transfer from the battlefield in Afghanistan to Guantanamo is still classed as extraordinary rendition. But then you had another definition, which is the involvement of a third state. And that's the definition I've been working with. So extraordinary rendition involves the arrest in or the transfer to another state that's separate from the Afghan battlefield and Guantanamo. So it involves a third state in that respect. It involves, say, Pakistan, Egypt, Morocco, Thailand. You know, the list is familiar to anyone who's read on this. With this qualification, with the involvement of this third state, the numbers, of course, drop from the 750 or so detainees at Guantanamo. And reading the recently released documents from the OLC to the CIA, the figure that appears there is that, and this, of course, was written in 2005, the figure there is that 94 detainees have been in CIA custody, and of these, 28 detainees have been subjected to enhanced interrogation techniques. Okay, so that's the first part that I want to talk about, definitions and numbers. Now, the arguments, the second point I want to make is about the arguments that have been put forward by the Office of the Legal Counsel, by you, Bybee, and Bradbury, in these memos to clear the legal space for the CIA. And in my reading, and for the purpose of summary, I think these arguments fall into two categories. The first has to do with the definition of torture, and the second has to do with the location of the interrogation, where the actual interrogation takes place. Now, what I want to do towards the end of the presentation is pick up on those second arguments based on the location of the interrogation to draw some implications for international relations students and those of us who are international relations academics. But I do feel it necessary and do want to say something about this first set of arguments, which is that the actions, according to the OLC, fell short of torture. So I'll say a bit about that now. And the focus of the OLC memos here is on section 2340 of the US Criminal Code. And this defines torture as, quote, an act committed by a person acting under the colour of law, specifically intended to inflict severe physical or mental pain or suffering upon another person within his custody or physical control, and severe mental pain or suffering means prolonged mental harm. Now, if you read the OLC memo, they focus in on these words, severe and prolonged, as well as that phrase, specifically intended. And what they essentially argue is that the interrogation methods that were being proposed by the CIA did not amount to torture, either individually or in combination. So there's two memos that have been released. One deals with the techniques individually, and the follow-on deals with them in combination. And the main evidence that they present for this is the fact that the techniques being proposed are drawn from the US Navy's training program, the so-called SEER program, a program called Survival, Evasion, Resistance, and Escape. And what they argue is that because recruits had been through this SEER, because US Navy recruits had been through this training program and had not suffered severe physical pain or prolonged mental harm, that these interrogation techniques fell short of torture. What they also argue is the fact that medical staff were on site, that medical staff were in the interrogation room or the proposed interrogation rooms. This meant that the interrogators did not intend to cause severe harm or prolonged mental harm. And on this basis, the conclusion is that under Section 2340 of the US Code, that posed no obstacle to the proposed techniques of the CIA. Now, like I say, I'm not a lawyer, but you know, we all have opinions on this. And the obvious point for me to say here is, of course, that the contexts were completely different. You had, on the one hand, a training program of for US soldiers who presumably signed up knowing they're not going to be harmed by their trainers. And then you have the war on terror. And, of course, the contexts are completely different. What's interesting here also is something that Mark Danner points out in his commentary on the Red Cross report that was released earlier this month. What Mark Danner notes is that the Navy, in fact, selected these techniques for their training program under the assumption that they would themselves be illegal if they were being used for real. So it's very hard to accept the OLC's argument that the training program can be used as evidence that the enhanced interrogation techniques were in fact lawful. Okay, so that's the first set of arguments that the OLC uses, that the techniques fall short of torture. As I said, what I want to do is draw some implications for international relations from the second set of arguments used by the OLC. And these tend to argue that the location of the interrogations, where the interrogations took place, they tend to argue that this matters, and that the law could not restrain the CIA because the interrogations took place outside of the United States, outside of a territory under US jurisdiction. So, for instance, the rendition memo that I talked about earlier, it deals with Article 3 of the Convention Against Torture. And Article 3, as was mentioned, this states that state parties to the Convention Against Torture should not expel, return, or extradite where there are substantial grounds for believing that torture will result. Now, the OLC argues here that each of these terms, expel, return, extradite, each of these involves the individual suspect first being on the territory, or at least trying to get into the territory of the United States. And then it concludes that this Article 3 of the Convention of Torture makes no sense when considering the transfer of a prisoner held outside the US in another country. So for the OLC, CIA involvement in the transfer of someone from Pakistan to Morocco is not outlawed by the Article 3 of the Convention of Torture because it's the US acting outside a territory under its jurisdiction. Now, the memo makes a similar argument with regard to Article 16 of the Convention Against Torture. This insists that, quote, each state party shall undertake to prevent in any territory under its jurisdiction other acts of cruel, inhuman, or degrading treatment or punishment. So it makes the argument that the interrogation techniques fall short of torture. Now it's concerned about cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment, and it focuses in on Article 16's prohibition, which again says that states shall prevent cruel and inhuman treatment on territory under its jurisdiction. However, the OLC, Bybee, you, Bradbury, use a very narrow definition of what territory under its jurisdiction means. So it says, it defines territory under its jurisdiction to mean, quote, at least de facto authority as the government. So in this sense, the convention again does not apply to prisoners rendered outside the territory controlled by the US government. Finally, the OLC takes a definition of cruel, inhuman, and degrading treatment that centers on US constitutional jurisprudence. So it looks at what is cruel and inhuman and degrading treatment, and it looks at cases to do with the Fifth Amendment in the United States Constitution. And then it says, but the US constitutional guarantees do not apply to aliens outside the US. So it's making an argument that's based on territoriality, which I'll come back to in a moment. And in fact, I've got a quote here from FBI agent Dan Coleman, who this is not his view, but it is his view of how the CIA saw these things. Whatever they do is all right. It takes place overseas. So as long as it's outside territory and jurisdiction, that is the argument that is being advanced by the OLC here. Now, this reading, of course, is by no means accepted in the legal literature. For instance, Margaret Satterthwaite argues that Article 3 of the Convention Against Torture applies to state parties regardless of where they are acting. Besides, she notes that the UN Committee Against Torture has developed a broader definition of that phrase, territory under its jurisdiction. And this includes effective control over an individual as well as effective control over territory. And this is called, she says, the personal control test. And she concludes that if you apply this, then the law extends to cover extraordinary rendition cases carried out by the United States, no matter where they originate. So, of course, the law that is being advanced by the OLC, like I say, is not it is up for debate. Now, I'm not going to argue one way or the other here. Rather, what I said, I'm going to stick to my purpose, which is to draw some implications for international relations, and in particular for its understanding of the concept of international society, which is, of course, at the centre of the English school approach that Kirsten mentioned by way of introduction. And what I'd say here is that the OLC's vision of international relations is quite clearly one that is ordered on a territorial conception of sovereignty and a territorial conception of responsibility. From this perspective, the US government has a duty to prevent torture on its own territory, but beyond that, it has little or no legal obligation. The question of whether to use enhanced interrogation techniques, or the question of whether to send an individual to a state that is known to use these techniques, this question becomes purely political. The OLC lawyers, one might say, are the organic intellectuals that help to construct what international relations scholars call the anarchic international system. Anarchy is what states construct. Anarchy is what states make of it, to use that phrase from Alexander Wendt. Well, here they are constructing an anarchical international system where what goes on outside of the state is pure politics. It's not governed by the rule of law. But it's lawyers that are constructing that. Now, having said that, what I'd also say is if one notices the geography, the geographic makeup of the rendition program, I would also argue that the US has acted politically for sure, but it's acted in a way that still tries to maintain the idea that there is some kind of international society. So, for instance, interrogation sites not only existed outside the US, they existed outside what might be called the zone of established liberal democracies. The terrorist suspects, in effect, crossed a line. They crossed a line that separated a torture-free zone of established liberal democracies from a zone of exception where different rules applied. They went from Italy to Egypt, from the US to Syria, from the UK to Morocco, etc., etc. And here's the influence of Schmitt's linear thinking, right? That there isn't a global international society, but there's a persistent tendency to see the world through what Schmitt calls linear thinking, where there's an inside of civilization and an outside of uncivilization. So rather than a globally inclusive international society based on human rights, extraordinary rendition operates on the assumption that there is an inside and an outside. In this respect, it suggests, and here I come back to my title, it symbolizes the retreat of international society. Not a full-blown retreat to anarchy of the realist worldview, but a retreat to a world order of a previous age, one that was characterized by discourses of civilization and discourses of barbarism. Now, 3 minutes?
Yeah.
Okay. A little bit more time left to say something about Obama in this context. He is, I think, trying to walk a very thin line. He has, as we've heard, expressed a wish to move on. And to look forward. And some have interpreted this as his preference for immunity. I'm not certain this is the case. If he was this way inclined, as I understand it, he could have issued a pardon and come into office, a pardon that President Bush could not have issued because, of course, President Bush didn't think they'd done anything wrong. So to issue a pardon would have contradicted himself. So Obama could have issued a pardon, but he hasn't. So I don't think he is in favour of immunity. But he's got to be very careful here, and this is the thin line he's walking. Because if he appeared too anxious to prosecute, then that might reduce the law to a party political point. that it's Democrats getting their revenge on the Republicans. And that would be as damaging for the law as not prosecuting. However, not prosecuting, I think, does damage the law because it also reduces the question of torture to a policy dispute between Republicans and Democrats, to put it simplistically. I mean, that's oversimplistic, but you can see the point. So this is a very difficult situation for, I think, for the president. And at the moment, he's still in the honeymoon period for me, and I think he can't be seen to be anxious to prosecute, but at the same time, he can't, give up on the idea of prosecutions. And I'll end by noting that criminal prosecutions are not the only form of redress, and this was picks up on something Jane was saying. The Jeppesen Data Plan legal action, the company accused of assisting the CIA running its extraordinary rendition program. Now, it's Binyam Mohammed is one of the individuals listed on the complaint. Now, he is allowed to bring this action in a US court under something called the Alien Tort Statute. And I've written about this elsewhere. I don't have time to go into the history of it, but this is goes back to this first 1789 Judiciary Act in the US, which allows foreign nationals to sue for breaches of the law of nations. And there's a strange history surrounding that, and I'm happy to go into that. But it's worth mentioning that when Dolly Filatiga used this statute, she was a Paraguayan national, used this statute to sue the torturer of her brother in a New York court, John Vincent, I haven't forgotten him, called this a glimpse of a solidarist world order of the future, the idea of a global international society based on human rights. Now, if that vision, I conclude, is to survive the recent onslaught from the OLC's memos, then it's surely right, I would argue, that Mohammed and others listed on that complaint should have their day in court.
Jason, thank you very much. Well, thank you both for two fascinating presentations. I'm sure they've raised a lot of thoughts. We've got 20 minutes left for questions, and because we've got a fair period of time left, if you want to ask slightly longer questions or you want to make comments, then please do. But can I just ask that you wait for a microphone to come to you before you make your comment or ask your question, and also identify yourself. Yes, please. And if you'll take it.
My name's Asim Qureshi. I work for the NGO Cage Prisoners. Jason, I was quite interested in what you were saying about essentially what's... I term as a backsliding of human rights in terms of the international arena, when you have US, UK and others essentially cooperating with Egypt, Syria and other such countries in terms of the detention of individuals abroad. And one of the key features that we've seen over the last couple of years especially, particularly in 2007, was the escalation of the war on terror in the Horn of Africa with Ethiopia invading Somalia. And myself and a colleague from Reprieve, Clara Guttridge, we actually went out there in the aftermath of the conflict, and we were actually trying to trace the detentions of individuals coming out of the conflict zone from Somalia into Kenya, who were then eventually rendered back into Somalia and then onto Ethiopia. And the way I see it is this was an exact replica of what took place in Southeast Asia. So what you had was Afghanistan being the conflict zone, same as Somalia. Individuals went into Pakistan and in the Horn of Africa context went into Kenya, and there they were picked up by security agencies, rendered back into the conflict zone, and then rendered to a third party country. So in the case of Pakistan and Afghanistan, it was Guantanamo, and in the case of the Horn of Africa, it was Ethiopia. And interestingly, in Ethiopia, when the detainees who were rendered, and this included men, women, and very, very young children, who were on these flights. There was even a pregnant woman who had been shot in the back who was put on one of the flights. When they were brought in front of the court, the judge actually explained to them that right now we're trying to assess who you are and whether or not you're enemy combatants. And that term was explicitly used in front of the detainees. And I think another interesting aspect, based on what Jane was talking about, is the way that we actually took the lessons that we learned from our work in Pakistan and Afghanistan and applied them immediately from day one in the Horn of Africa. And the results that were produced in terms of the release of detainees were far quicker than anything we've seen before. And it's simply because of all the lessons that were learned in the Horn of Africa and the extent to which these countries were able to get away with it, and obviously trying to put pressure on the governments that were involved. So I think there are important similarities that need to be drawn. Also the fact that, you know, other countries such as Ethiopia are now taking their example from the US and thinking that they can get away in the same way, but that's not necessarily, of course, the case. Thank you.
Thank you. I was really not too...
Yeah, I think, Asim, you raised a really good point about the situations that enable people to be apprehended and transferred out of a particular country, and conflict is one of them. We know, we didn't talk about it very much, but definitely the United States has applied its like war on terror paradigm to justify certain violations that it couldn't undertake if they're applying human rights paradigm. So the conflict aspect really muddies the water. Another thing that we didn't talk about but is important to note is a lot of countries, when you're picked up, you're often picked up as a non-citizen in that country, and so there is a manipulation of immigration regimes there as well that sort of ensures that people are easily kidnapped and transferred out. I think just one quick comment, and I was going to make it on Jason's presentation, but I think your point raises it too, is this whole idea of insider and outsider states is really interesting for me to hear from you, and I wonder how you take account of the role of European states in the rendition and secret detention interrogation program by the United States government. And that role is really quite multifaceted. I mean, it extends from providing overflight or refueling services, but right up to actually hosting secret prisons too, which is really quite an active role, and I think challenges that dichotomy that you set up. But also to talk about in the UK context too, the role of using torture evidence, being present in interrogations of detainees, that happened, for example, in the Australian government case as well. So I actually think it's very important not to fall into the trap of talking about civilized and non-civilized states, but actually to recognize that interstate cooperation has taken place on all levels and has implicated a number of different actors, particularly those governments who have previously maintained a commitment to human rights.
Okay. Yes, please. Yeah, I'll just come back on that and then I'll make a point there. This is very much work in progress, and I'm conscious that drawing a line between insiders and outsiders it is not necessarily easy to do, because that line becomes blurred and you've picked up on some of it. And also the point is that I'm not suggesting that the states that do the rendering are civilized, but they're just trying to maintain the perception that they're civilized, because, as Bush put it, we do not torture.
Yep.
But quite clearly, they're considering what they call enhanced interrogation techniques outside, and that's what my paper was trying to get at by looking at the OLC arguments. But then there's also your question about the allegations of European involvement. I've seen Poland and Romania listed in this light. And this was on my mind when phrasing this paper, and I use the phrase established liberal democracies. And I think the very fact that these kind of states would do this kind of thing suggests that they're not established liberal democracies, if they're considering that kind of, but I'm conscious that that line that I'm trying to draw is blurred. But this point about enemy combatants and the label that was used, what I didn't have time to go into, but these memos do also talk about possibility that as enemy combatants, individuals could be protected by the Third Geneva Convention, and that too stops the removal of enemy combatants, prisoners of war, from the battlefield. But of course, what the Bush administration lawyers argued was that the Geneva Conventions do not apply, because we're dealing here with Al-Qaeda. Al-Qaeda is a non-state actor. A non-state actor cannot consent to the Geneva Conventions, therefore the Geneva Conventions do not apply, and this is a new war, and we haven't yet regulated. That was their argument. So, and that also, again, appears in the rendition memo, as I'm calling it. that I just dealt with the US Code and the Convention Against Torture, but we could also bring in the Geneva Conventions there. Yes, these are enemy combatants, but they're not protected under the Geneva Conventions for reasons I talked about, and therefore we can shift them around the world in any way we want. That's what they argue. Yeah.
Interjecting here myself as well. I mean, this idea of the exception is, I think, fascinating when you look at the discourse of civilised and uncivilised, because we have this feeling that there is a civilised world, and the way the US in particular, but also the UK, has talked about the actions necessary in the war on terror has been that in order to save civilisation, the most civilised have at times to act in an uncivilised way. And there's almost a feeling that, well, at least you could trust the US. If anybody's going to do this, then one of the world's most established democracies is the right one to save civilization. And there's the desire to be seen as within the in-group, within civilization, and protecting civilization, and yet hiding actions which are clearly uncivilized, and recruiting those who are uncivilized to help you do so. It seems to be really fascinating at different times who's claiming to be within which group. Nobody wants to claim to be within the uncivilized group. So there was almost a third position, which is the protector of the civilized world, where we need to just occasionally suspend our values in order to protect them. So it makes so little sense when one one looks at the logic of it, and yet this is something which seems to be part of the discourse. Let me bring in there a couple more people that want to make points to that.
Oh, yeah, very quickly. I actually think it's very important when talking about the Romania and Poland example to appreciate the reasons why they participated in the Secret Detention Rendition Programme. And it was really seen, this comes out most clearly in the Council of Europe reports, but also in other fora as well. It was really seen as a way of them demonstrating their commitment to the international legal community. So it wasn't actually that they were acting as aberrant, like illiberal democracies. It was really a way of them showing how they could be brought within the framework. And in particular, it was like seen as a predecessor to their NATO membership as well. So if you go and have a... I think it's very interesting from a... talking about your notion of civilised and uncivilised, to really think about what are the markers of civilised behaviour. And in this context, that was the way of demonstrating that commitment.
Yeah, it is being a friend of the US, does that make you civilised or uncivilised?
It depends which community you want to. I mean, do you want to be part of a political, military community like NATO? Mm-hmm. And I can understand why they'd do that. Or do you want to be part of a legal community that respects human rights?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. You bring some others into this. Yes.
Hi, I'm Julia Hall. I am interested that neither one of you mentioned the other justification for renditions, and this is the one that really has a much longer shelf life, and that is the U.S. policy to secure diplomatic assurances for any transfer where a person is at risk of torture or treatment. The memos will go down in history, and, you know, PhD students will make their careers off of them, but this is a lasting, practical counterterrorism tool that has now been widely accepted as the human rights-friendly answer to the problem of renditions and other types of transfers. And I'm consistently surprised that in fora like this, this issue is not necessarily ignored, and I realize I'm the international squeaky wheel on diplomatic assurances. I understand my position. But I'm curious to know whether or not the human rights community and the academic community is actually going to finally give in to this, because we've come so far in the extreme with renditions, and Obama and Panetta are trying, to some extent, bring us back to the center, mixed bag. But the key thing that they're focusing on, the task force on interrogation and rendition, the rendition team, very small team, is how to perfect diplomatic assurances to effect transfers in the future. And this is the really, it's the crux of the matter at this point. And I'm curious to know how you see the issue of diplomatic assurances, what the status is of them right now. And I am very curious in the long run to know whether people who have either criticized them, who've taken absolute positions or see their problems, are suddenly now, given the political landscape, going to say, okay, finally, we're just going to, let's heave the last sigh, like we fought the good fight, and now diplomatic assurances actually are the answer.
I mean, from a human rights perspective, diplomatic assurances are not the answer. I mean, that's been the lesson not only for the last 8 years, but previously too. I mean, if you have to seek an assurance from a country they won't torture, that's already a sign that you're in murky territory. And also, I mean, you know better than anyone, there are issues about sort of the level to which they're public, not public, issues about are they informal, are they formal, issues about do they have enforceability mechanisms. I think those are all side questions to aim to perfect what is an imperfect, inherently imperfect mechanism. That if you are seeking to transfer someone, if you are asking for an assurance, there's a very good chance that the real risk of transfer is there, and then therefore you shouldn't be engaging in the transfer. But that's something that I know is a very hard position to defend in a US context, but at an international human rights law context is much more palatable.
Peter Wilson, LSE. The Office of Legal Counsel, do we know to what extent it gave the Bush administration what it wanted? International law is the art of the possible. There will be a number of international lawyers, some of them very senior and experienced in that office, whose job it is to serve the prince. Are we aware of any dissenting voices? Were there any resignations or suspicious early retirements, as there were over the war in Iraq in the United Kingdom?
Yeah, the dissenting voices that are documented come from the State Department, and specifically on the question that I was talking about of whether to apply the Geneva Conventions to detainees. And you had Colin Powell and Taft, was it?
William Taft.
Who objected to this on both legal but also on political grounds, that it was not in US interests. And of course, what you have in the State Department of the Bush administration, a former Vietnam veterans, Powell Armitage, who saw the Geneva Conventions as something worth keeping because it protected US servicemen. And I've read one report where Armitage in the State Department, and I should say I've only read one report here, so I don't know how accurate it is, but this reported Armitage is saying he'd been through the interrogation techniques, the training programs himself, and it did not work. It did not provide reliable evidence. So there is dissension from within the State Department quite clearly on the whole legal regime that was set up to govern detention policy and, I think, here interrogation policy. No, Department of Justice. Yes.
Yeah, within the OLC, I mean, there has been dissension and so forth over the years. If you want to like track the different objections that were raised and at which point and the nature of the objections, there's many materials you can look at for that. For example, Jane Mayer's book, The Dark Side, is probably the best account of the internal dynamics that were happening not only within DOJ but within Department of State and so forth at the time, but also the interagency conflicts that were happening as well. There are also books by former OLC employees as well. So it's definitely there is a degree. I think it would be a mistake to assume that everyone was on board within these entities with the legal argumentation being advanced. That being said, back to your first question, which is, did the president get what he wanted? Yes, and more. I mean, if you read these memos, it's an extraordinary blank check. to undertake activities which are illegal under international law, clearly.
Okay, there are three more people that would like to come into this. I'm going to take all three comments together and then give the speakers a chance to wrap up to keep us close to on being on time. So, yes, please.
I just wanted to make a point about the OLC memos. They are absolutely not an exercise in rigorous legal argumentation in any way. They're incredibly selective, and I think this is what Sitherwaite talks about a lot in her work as well, is that they would pick up, you know, a bit from the Constitution and ignore a whole raft from international law. And really it was a case of being a justification, as you say, a carte blanche for the administration. But this made me think about something that Jane said about using private planes as being a means of minimising detection. In my view, they were also a means of minimising liability. There was a real acknowledgement through getting these memos, through choosing private contractors, that what was happening was unlawful no matter what they said. And in some ways that's depressing because they went ahead and did it anyway. But in some ways, if you looked at it from a liberal legalistic viewpoint, there is still this kind of pang of acknowledgement that what one is doing is not lawful. And that is a positive thing to take from it. But one thing I think is significant, and which you may find useful, is you need to contrast, I think, the nature of the lawyers in the OLC and the nature of the lawyers in state. And what I mean by that is that if you're in OLC, generally, you're taken out from, you know, so you're some promising law professor like John Yeo, and you're taken out and you're put in for a secondment, whereas in state, they're generally career government employees. And it shows again and again, if you distinguish between OLC positions and military positions, for example. So the difference between the almost opportunistic OLC writing, but if you read one of John Yeo's law review articles and one of his memos, it doesn't look any different, right? It looks like he's writing a law review article as opposed to something that has a real policy implication. So I think that's significant. But the last point about insider and outsider within...